Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take to give the gift of literacy to the nearly 800 million citizens of today's world who lack it? For John Wood, it starts with providing school libraries, and in many cases schools themselves, to remote and impoverished communities in Asia and Africa, with a particular but not exclusive focus on the two-thirds of the illiterate population who are women and girls. In 1999, John Wood left a high-powered, high-paying executive job with Microsoft to devote time to his newfound vocation. In 2000, he founded nonprofit organization Room to Read, which has since established more than 1,600 schools and more than 15,000 and small libraries worldwide. His new book is called Creating Room to Read, a story of hope in the battle for global literacy. He's in town to speak this afternoon and this evening to the SMU Forum and the Communities Foundation of Texas. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and it's always great to be back in Dallas.
So what is the relationship between a society's literacy rate and its overall security and economic stability?
You can basically graph literacy rates in education and look at all the things that happen as a result of that, and there's a positive relationship. People who are educated have higher incomes. People who are educated have more healthy families. Educated women in the developing world are twice as likely to vaccinate their children. You can even graph life expectancy versus literacy rates. And the higher society's literacy rates are, the longer people can live. And it literally can be a 2-3-4-decade gap between the most literate societies like Japan and Finland and the least literate like Haiti and Zambia. So I think if you get education right and you get literacy right, a lot of other things come along with that. It is the one issue that has the ripple effect. It has an effect on every other issue.
Forgive me for what it seems like an obvious question, but how much proficiency is required to consider someone literate?
I think it depends on how you want to define literacy. Mm-hmm. And in the old days, people used to define it as whether you could actually read and write your name and as opposed to signing an X. But obviously, there's different measures. There's second or third grade levels of literacy. There's eighth grade levels. There's higher levels of literacy. And there's really it's about whether you can you read something? Can you comprehend it? Can you act on it? I mean, imagine if you went through life or I went through life looking at street signs, not being able to read them, looking at signs for a store and not knowing what that store was. That would be a very frustrating experience if you couldn't read or if you couldn't pass on knowledge to your children. Yet, as you mentioned in the beginning of this segment, 800 million people in the world today still cannot read or write, nearly a billion people. And that, to me, just seems grossly unfair.
One thing that we complain a lot about the education system in this country and we worry about it, but we take for granted universal free public education. And this is something that does not exist in many parts of the world.
That's exactly right. I think we take a lot of things for granted. We take for granted the fact that Andrew Carnegie back in the 19th century opened 2,500 libraries across America. And in one brilliant move, he removed the idea that you could be too poor to gain knowledge. And that's really what Room to Read's all about. We're trying to say, let's go to the communities in the poorest parts of the world where they're literally too poor to afford education, but if they don't get educated, they're always going to remain poor. And if you think about an underperforming school, that's one thing. If you think about a kid who actually doesn't have access to a school at all, that's totally different. If you think about a library that has to shut early because of budget cuts, that's sad. But think about the fact that, you know, a billion kids don't have access to books or libraries. That, to me, is just a huge vacuum, but it's also a huge opportunity because if we can fix that, I think that is one part of the solution for global poverty and the fact that a billion people live in less than a dollar a day, that 2 billion people live in less than $2 a day. That's nearly a third of humanity. And I just think that we have an opportunity here to help kids in some of the poorest parts of the world to pick themselves up by their bootstraps, to educate themselves. And to me, education is ultimately a hand up, not a handout.
I want to talk about, I don't want to call it the foundation myth because I know your story is true, but it really is pretty amazing tale of how you went from being this, you know, sort of mid-30s, top of your game, hotshot executive to being someone who essentially turned his whole life over to this non-lucrative but very important cause.
Yes, we call the story, a boy in a jack. I was off in Nepal in 1998. I was running large parts of Microsoft's marketing for Asia and Australia, and went on an 18-day trek in Nepal to just get away from it all. There was a rumor that if you went high enough in the Himalayas, you could escape the sound of Steve Ballmer yelling at you to work harder. And so I went off to try to enjoy myself, and I met a headmaster the second day of my trek who wanted to give me a tour of his school. He was very proud of it. But like many schools in the poorest parts of the world, it was simultaneously hopeful but rather pathetic. Hopeful because 450 kids were showing up every day. They wanted to be educated. Their parents wanted them to be educated. yet they did not have much of anything. They had dirt floors, sheet metal roof that leaked during a rainy season, turning the dirt floors to mud. They had 80 kids crammed into a room that had no desks in it. And then the headmaster said to me, well, come see the library. And I naively thought the library would be the really fun part of the tour. I mean, right. I grew up, I'm proud to say, you know, I'm an NPR, so I can say it right. I was a library nerd as a kid. I loved to go to the library as a child. So I thought this will be the fun part of the tour. Kids with smiles on their faces reading books. Well, the reality was we walked into the library. It was dark. It was empty. It was completely devoid of children's books. They didn't have any children's books. And I said to the headmaster, how is that? 450 kids, no books. And he said, well, in Nepal, we are too poor to afford education. But until we have education, we are always going to remain poor. And that struck me. That hit me in the gut to think, how do you tell a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old you've lost the lottery of life? You're not going to learn to read. You're not going to get educated. And you will be the umpteenth generation to remain in abject poverty. Now, thankfully, the headmaster, like me, was an action-oriented optimist. He gave me a homework assignment. He said, perhaps, sir, you will someday come back with books. And in my new book, I write about that moment of going back a year later, my 73-year-old father in tow. We had 3,000 books. We had 6 rented donkeys to carry the books. And it was the biggest day in the history of the village. And it was really that day seeing the smiles in the faces of the kids, having grandmothers coming up to us with tears in their eyes, thanking us for the fact that their little granddaughters and grandsons would be the first in their family to ever learn to read. That day in 1999 is the day I started to kind of make my move towards the exit at Microsoft.
What did reading represent for those children and those families who did not necessarily have access to the kinds of data that you just mentioned and all the economic numbers and that sort of thing?
I think what reading means most is just empowerment. I mean, I think we forget that because we have near universal literacy in the developed world. I mean, things aren't perfect here, but 98% of the people in the world today who cannot read or write are in the poorest countries of the world. So 49 out of 50 people. And if you think about the fact that what would life be like if you saw a newspaper and couldn't pick it up and read it, or a book or a magazine, you would feel marginalized and not empowered. And, you know, talking about the issue of for girls and women especially, I think this should not be marginalized as a women's issue, because educated mothers are going to benefit their sons as much as they benefit their daughters. And if you think about, like, for my life, for example, I have an educated grandmother who read to me, an educated mother who read to me, an educated older sister who read to me. So I'm a product of those 3 strong women. Had I not had it in my life, I probably never would have gone to a good graduate school, probably would have never gotten through Microsoft's competitive process. So to me, a lot of it is about empowerment, self-sufficiency, but also optimism, that people, if you have the ability to control your destiny, you're going to be much more optimistic and much more peaceful because you don't feel like you got a raw deal on life.
You talk about your mother and your grandmother and your sister. I was really interested to read the reality of educated mothers. There's almost a 100% guarantee that they will pass literacy onto their children.
It's exactly true. And that, in that sense, education is the gift that keeps on giving. I try to remind myself, and I try to remind a lot of our investors at Room to Read, that unfortunately we're all going to die at some point. So the question is, what kind of legacy do we want to live? Do we want to leave behind when we do go? And to me, the legacy of a generation of empowered, educated women would be the greatest thing in the world, because every child then of those mothers is going to benefit. And it's possible to end poverty in 1 or 2 generations if we make sure that every girl in the developing world is educated. We've seen it. I mean, there's certainly enough case studies, be it the United States, Canada, France, Sweden. You see what happens when a generation of women gets educated. And I mean, I see this every day at Room to Read, the organization, because over half our leadership are strong, educated women. And that's one of the reasons Room to Read's done so well, is because we are strong men, strong women, united in the idea that every child should get educated.
What do we know about the link between female literacy and child mortality?
It is a direct link that the more years of schooling a young woman will receive, the lower will be the rates of maternal mortality, the lower will be the rates of infant mortality, and the greater the likelihood that that woman will vaccinate her children. So it all, I think, really ties together. Now, the fun thing about this, and I talk about this quite a bit in my book, is that Room to Read's program model is, you know, don't want to advertise ourselves too much, but our program model is such that we can help a girl to get educated for $250 per girl per year, because money goes so far in the developing world. And if you think about that for a minute, that for the $250 is the difference between a girl going to school and not going to school, it's just shockingly small amount of money that stands in the way of changing this age-old situation of girls and women not going to school. So it's not expensive. The girls and the families are lining up to get their daughters in school. So at Room to Read, our question is, why don't we do this for a lot more girls and boys in the developing world, given that it's not an expensive proposition.
So again, we are lucky in this country, in the developed world, to be able to take that sort of thing for granted. We are not, even the poorest among us are not in a position of having to choose, okay, do I send my 10-year-old to school? Do I send my 10-year-old to work?
Exactly.
And it's easy to sort of jump on that and judge and say, well, how can you be so short-sighted? But there are families that really feel like that 10-year-old's labor is the difference between the family's survival or really perilous poverty. Can you talk about the ways that Room to Read has come to understand this problem and try to approach it with families who are not kidding and not being selfish when they are making this decision?
Mm-hmm. It is a very real issue for families when they say, we can only afford to send one child to school. Let's send the eldest son. And then you have the daughters and maybe some of the other boys that are left behind. One of the key parts of Room to Read's model is that we employ very strong local staff who understand the local conditions. Where we always say, you know, we're not a bunch of overpaid expats driving around in air-conditioned Land Rovers telling the developing world how to solve their problems.
We got enough of those out there.
Yeah, exactly. At Room to Read, we employ strong Cambodians in Cambodia, strong South Africans in South Africa, and because they know the local conditions. One of the best roles at Room to Read is a role called the social mobilizer, and these are usually very well-educated by local standards women who work for us, who go out and work in the communities to say, here's all the reasons we would like to make sure that your daughters and your sons go to school, and then work with the girls to teach them how not to get pregnant, why they might want to avoid early marriage, what they might be able to do with their lives if they graduate from secondary school. And those social mobilizers are the ones who are really working in the communities to say, let us work with you to do whatever needs to be done, whether it's building a school, having literacy training for the teachers, building a library, getting kids into a habit of reading. What's also great about that is that the communities that we work with all co-invest in everything we do. We don't go in and build the school for the community or open the library for them. We tell the community, we will work with you, but we can only help you if you want to help yourself. So everything that we do has community co-investment. We call it the challenge grant model, where, okay, we'll help you, but we're only going to help you if you want to help yourself. And then the governments get involved also, and the local ministries of education also provide resources by paying the salaries for the teachers and paying the salaries for the librarians. So when you mentioned those numbers of 1,600 schools opened, 15,000 libraries opened, it wasn't just Room to Read doing it. It was also the governments and the local communities coming in and co-investing with us.
Is there ever resistance from the local governments in particular?
Not really very much. What has most surprised me in this 12-year journey is how little resistance there has been. And we have, I don't know what the opposite of resistance is, but when you have governments lining up to say, we want to work with you, that's actually the issue we have. When we announce that we have a certain number of spots available in our girls' education program, we're oversubscribed. When we announce every year that we're going to be able to have the funding to build, let's say, 150 or 200 new schools, we are oversubscribed, even though we're requiring the local communities to put their own assets and their own sweat equity in. Now, I do believe, you know, if I was to go to North Korea tomorrow and say, hey, we'd love to open schools, there probably would be resistance in some places of the world. But what we've actually found is that a lot of communities and governments are actually lining up because they know that this is the issue, that if they can solve this issue, they will find themselves working their way out of poverty. And you see examples all around the world, from Singapore to South Korea to Taiwan to Hong Kong, where countries that were in poverty two generations ago have used education as the rising tide that's lifted all boats. And so at Room to Read, our hope is let's do that same thing for many other parts of the world.
John Wood is with us. He is founder and board co-chair of Room to Read and adjunct professor of social entrepreneurship at NYU's Wagner School of Public Policy. His new book is called Creating Room to Read, a story of hope in the battle for global literacy. He's in town to speak today to the SMU Forum and the Communities Foundation of Texas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Wood. He is founder and board co-chair of Room to Read and adjunct professor of social entrepreneurship at the Wagner School of Public Policy at NYU. His new book is called Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. He's in town to speak tonight to the SMU Forum and the Communities Foundation of Texas. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, talk about how you make decisions about where you will locate the program and how you will train local folks.
The key decisions about where we work and what communities we work with are all made by our local teams. And it really, I think, is empowering for those people in a place like Cambodia or Vietnam for us to say we're not going to send Americans overseas to tell you what to do. We're going to empower you locally to make these key decisions. What the local teams do is go out and survey different rural communities to find out what their needs are. In some cases, they might have a school that has grades 1, 2, and 3, but they want to add on grades above 3, add on 4 through 8 or 4 through 10, and they need help with that. In some cases, the village may have a functioning school, but they may not have good literacy programs, or they may not have a library, so the kids are not taking books home at night. In many cases, they might have gender inequality. So what happens then is that Room to Read sits down with the local community, literally, and sometimes they're with sticks drawing in the dirt these equations that will say, okay, here's what we can do, what can the local community do? And so the community level, they will donate land to get a school built. The parents quite often will volunteer sweat equity. They may volunteer to carry the building supplies from the roadside up the donkey path up
to the little
mountain
village.
Which is no small
task in a lot of these places you work.
No, yeah. We've seen villages in rural Laos, one of the poorest countries in Asia, that literally have built bridges, literally built bridges over streams so that the trucks can come in with the cement to get the school built. Parents will come out and dig the foundation for the school. They might come out and paint the walls of the library or build the shelves. So the whole thing is really it's a co-investment model. And the more that the local community is willing to invest, the more likely we are to invest alongside of them because we want the programs to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. Our country director from Nepal once told me, when you snip the red ribbon on the school or the library, your job's 5% done. The
yeah.
photo op's over, but now you have to make sure that these projects are sustainable and stay up and running in the long term.
The other thing that local engagement involves is the fact that you're not simply just taking copies of Diary of a Wimpy Kid or Captain Underpants and translating them into the local language or handing over English-only materials. You are working with individuals in those communities, in those countries, to craft literature that makes sense and is relevant to the students that you're serving.
Exactly. Why don't we say within Room to Read that one of our secret sauces is the ability to actually print books for children in these languages that have never had children's books before. And if you go kind of up to the 35,000-foot level for a minute, the reason that there are not books in these languages is because the parents can't afford books. They're too poor. So a for-profit publisher, let's say Scholastic, which is a big supporter of Room to Read, but Scholastic doesn't see a business case to print in a language like Lao or Khmer, or Vietnamese, Nepali, Setswana, Zulu, Xhosa, the list goes on and on and on. And if you look at the supply chain of poverty, I think this is a lot of why people stay poor, because if the 5-year-old or the 6-year-old can't read books in their mother tongue, they don't develop literacy, they don't develop a habit of reading. And so what chances are there that they're going to do very well in school? So Room to Read, basically, we're not about the problem. Mm-hmm. We're always about the solution. I'm very business-oriented, as is our management team. And so we said, let's become a publisher. Let's go find the Dr. Seuss of Cambodia. Let's go find the J.K. Rowling of South Africa and empower them to write and illustrate original children's books. We started small with a grant from the Skoll Foundation. Jeff Skoll, the founding president of eBay, gave us a small grant to get started in 2004 with our first 10 books in Nepal. Local authors, local artists, all original content. I'm proud to say that as of today, we are at 850 original books we've published. We will be at over 1,000 original titles by the end of this year. And I often say that Room to Read is the biggest children's publisher you've never heard of because we're publishing in all these kind of overlooked languages.
You know, it almost sounds, when I was reading about that, it sounds a little bit like the problem that people with rare diseases have with sort of orphan drugs that are not developed by pharmaceuticals. You almost can't, at least in the current climate, you won't be able to make a case for that. But the day may come from setting up these programs when someone could make money publishing books in these languages.
It's a perfect analogy. It's so true. I mean, you think about the fact that if people, I mean, how terrible is that, that somebody's too poor to be able to have a drug developed for them because they wouldn't be able to afford to pay large amounts of money for it. And it's the same thing with publishing. I mean, my thoughts are, and I've told our friends at Scholastic and Pearson and Penguin and other publishers this, I've said, if Room to Read does our job, those communities will eventually be your customers because you're going to have 800 million people today who are illiterate. If we can just help even half of that group get literate, then you've got 400 million people who may be buying books and may become bilingual or multilingual. So I do think that within one generation, and we've already seen it in Nepal, right? When we first started work in Nepal in 1999, we could not find children's books in the local language, but now a lot of those authors and artists that we've worked with are now off doing side projects. And so the markets of Kathmandu now have a lot of children's books in the local language that are not published by us. They're published by the for-profit publishers. And so we see that as being a great long tail that's going to benefit that country for a long time.
So there are various ways that you could have approached the literacy issue in developing countries and isolated communities. Why libraries rather than saying to each child, here are five books that you get to take home and keep?
I think libraries are valuable because they're viewed as being a community asset, and then the communities will invest in them. I'm not really reinventing the wheel. One of my heroes is Andrew Carnegie. And in my book—
Although you've left him in the dust now, number for number.
We have. I'm very proud of our team for that. Carnegie opened 2,500 libraries in his lifetime. We are now at Room to Read at 6x that. And the thing is, we were not, you know, a billionaire. I'm not a billionaire. Neither is anybody in my team like Carnegie. But we've all done this through fundraising throughout the world, including our amazing Dallas chapter, which is why I'm here today, Concerned Global Citizens. None of us are famous. None of us are billionaires. But together, we've done 6x Carnegie. But the reason I loved Carnegie's model was that when he was poor, he didn't have access to books because only the rich had access to books. And Carnegie said, we're going to end this forever and open libraries that will pay dividends, hopefully, for millions of people for generation after generation. Now, Carnegie helped the community to build the library, but he said, now it's up to the community to fill the library with books. That's an early version of our challenge grant. So much of what we're doing is not really making something up brand new. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We simply say, let's take this model that works. And in the case of Carnegie, what I said is, let's not just do 2,500. Let's try to do 5x or 10x or 15x Carnegie, because the addressable market is 800 million illiterate people. So we cannot think small about this. Mm-hmm. One library, 10 libraries, 1,000 libraries will not be enough. We have to aim much higher than that.
But you are putting the books in the libraries as opposed to the Carnegie model, leaving out maybe the stone lions out front. Talk a little bit about, for people who are having trouble visualizing this, what does the typical Room to Read library look like?
Picture a community that is underinvested in, out somewhere along a dusty backwater in a poor country in the developing world, and then picture this riot of color. You walk into a Room to Read library, and it is the only part of a village or a community that's designed around the needs of the child. The walls are brightly colored and painted. There's posters outside encouraging kids to come in to say, this is your library. The shelves are filled with books. It might be 1,000 or 2,000 books. It doesn't have to be a huge number. But this for the children, and the books are at the eye level. We're not putting the books behind glass doors or padlocking them up, right? We're making sure that these books are accessible to kids. 98% of our libraries now have checkout systems in place, so we can actually monitor how many books go home with the kids. So we hope that they pick up that habit of reading. And for many of the kids, it is just the most fun part of their day. Kids will come to school. They'll wake up at sunrise and come to school an hour early because it means they can come into the library. And again, this is not rocket science, but I do think this is a key way that we can solve poverty globally, that if we can get millions of kids into the habit of reading and getting to that point where they're just constantly increasing and improving their knowledge, I think that, what starts in that little library in grade one or two will pay huge dividends for generations. And I know this because there are students from the first library we opened back in 1999 who are now studying and preparing to go into medical school. And that's pretty amazing to think that in just 12 years that a child could take that trajectory.
Given Room to Read's commitment to gender equity, is there a tacit or explicit message in a significant portion of the books that your imprint is publishing that sort of promotes gender equality?
We do, definitely. One of the key things I think about gender equality is that you can't be too hectoring about it, mm-hmm. and you can't turn it into a divisive issue of boys versus girls.
Right.
I've always said at Room to Read, we're not anti-boy. Mm-hmm. As a former boy myself, I would never want to be accused of being anti-boy. Mm-hmm. When we open schools and we open libraries and we do literacy programs, they're open to both genders. So you won't find a single sex or single gender school anywhere in the Room to Read network. But because two-thirds of those who are out of school are girls and women, we try to not only get more girls into school, but we also try to put messages into our books that help kids to figure out that boys and girls can be seen as equal. So an example of this is, let's not have a story where the girl is doing the dishes and the boy's outside playing soccer. Maybe we reverse that. Mm-hmm. Or when you have books about the animals that are trying to solve a problem, make sure it's not just the boy animal that always comes up with a solution. Maybe it's the, you know, and these books, you know, you have a bunch of water buffalo sitting around talking as you can only
so
have.
So you're not hitting people over the head with this. It's just there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Sam in Fort Worth who wants to know what you do about corruption, graft. Do you have payoffs to local officials? Is that the sort of thing you have to budget for?
No. Hi, Sam. And my parents actually met in Fort Worth, Texas,
very nice.
Back in 1955. So without Fort Worth, I would not be around today. The key thing for us about corruption is we let governments know that they cannot ask us for bribes or money because we are going to reverse it. We're asking those governments for money. We're going to the governments to say, if we open a school, we're going to expect you to pay the teacher's salaries. When we open librarians, the governments are actually paying for the librarians' salaries. Many times the local governments are putting money into the construction funds. So I think one of the reasons corruption happens in the developing world is that people design things really stupidly, for lack of a better phrase. We have governments that will give these billion-dollar transfers government to government and then act surprised when the money doesn't get to the local people. What Room to Read does very much is all about giving assistance, but we're not going into a village and dropping down $30,000 of cash and hoping the school gets built. We go in and say, look, we're going to show up with the bricks. We'll show up with the cement. But because the local people are also co-investing, this is brilliant because people don't steal from themselves. And once every local family has put in 100 rupees or 200 rupees into a building fund, guess what? They're also policing how that fund is used because it's their resources.
So if the cost is $250 per student per year in the schools that you build, what's the cost of putting a library into a community?
That it's also extremely low cost. That's one reason we've been able to reach the scale that we've reached. And that's one reason when people say, well, why invest in the developing world? We have problems here at home. I always say, well, we should. We should invest everywhere. If you believe in education, invest locally, but at least invest something globally because the money goes so far. So in Cambodia, as an example, if the community has a school that has an empty room they can give us, it only takes us $5,000 to turn that room into a fully functioning library with a trained librarian. Now, the average library serves 400 children. So you're literally looking at $12.50 per child to give them access to something they would not have otherwise had that has the power to help them to escape poverty. If the community has an overcrowded school and they need to actually have us build a building, a library building, we call them mini Carnegies, $20,000 is enough to build one in Asia. About $40,000 is enough to build one in a place like Zambia where there's a lot more kids and so the library needs to be larger. And what's really fun about that is that we let people dedicate the projects to a loved one. And so my parents have a library in Cambodia that's named in their honor. They also have a school in Nepal that's named in their honor. And a lot of our schools and libraries are opened up because a company, Fossil here in Dallas is a great example. Fossil's opened a lot of schools and libraries through Room to Read. They not only will help us to open them, but they'll then put their name on the dedication plaque. Now, the dedication plaque salutes first the local community to thank them for their initiative and their efforts. But we also will then list the name of the donor. In many cases, it'll be, you know, in honor of my loving grandmother on her 80th birthday. Or we've had couples literally, as opposed to an engagement ring, they funded a library and put their name on it. So it's a pretty cool thing to see. I often say that
that's way more romantic than a piece of jewelry.
I often say that if in your family you suffer from sibling rivalry, dedicating a school or a library to your parents is like the nuclear option. You know, your siblings will not know what hit them.
Tell me a little about your mom and dad, because you write about, you sort of open the book with a story where they're present, and you write about the fact that many parents, given the shift in your sort of life's direction in your mid-30s, they hardly blinked an eye and have been supportive all the way. How do you think that the way you grew up sort of put you in the right position to do this work at the time that it occurred to you that it needed to be done?
My parent, this book turned a little bit, it started off as a love letter to education, and it became a little bit of a love letter to my parents in some ways to thank them for everything they did. I grew up, probably like many of your listeners, a middle-class kid. My father grew up in Denver. His father had a second-grade education. My father was the only one of seven children in his family to go to university, and the only reason he went was because of the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, we got lucky. My mother, when she was growing up in Duluth, Minnesota, was told that girls don't go to university. So right there in my family, you have on both sides, mother and father, you have lack of access to education. On my mother's side, she's super well-read but was told, you know, girls don't go to university. Mm-hmm. In my father's case, it was a scholarship. And my parents always said to me, education is the one thing. This sounds like a cliche because we hear it all the time, but it's cliches can be true. It's the one thing that when you have it, nobody can take it away from you. You'll always have it and you'll always be able to earn your own way in the world. So they stressed that quite often. And they also stressed to me, do the thing that you think is the right thing. Don't listen to what other people tell you. So I remember when I was in eighth grade, I was crying because it was the deadline to sign up for the football team. And my dad's like, what's the problem? And I said, well, I don't want to play. He said, well, if you don't want to play, don't play. And I said, yeah, well, the other kids are going to make fun of me. But I wasn't like a really big kid in eighth grade. And he's like, if you don't want to play football, don't play football. Go do your paper route, make some pocket money, whatever it might be. So when I quit Microsoft, it was almost like the same thing all over again. I said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to do this. It's kind of weird. People don't believe that it's the right thing to do. And they said, only you will know whether it's the right thing to do. And so I give them a lot of credit for sticking with me. And even in the early years, 2000 was a terrible time to launch a charity with the stock market melting down, the internet bubble bursting. Even during those tough times, they said, John, if you believe in this, it's going to take off. And I owe them a lot for that support.
Was there ever a time when you thought, I don't know that I can get this off the ground?
Very definitely. I remember going and doing a fundraising event at Microsoft in the early years, and I thought the room would be packed with people that I used to know, and they'll come out with their checkbooks. And I think we had, you know, 8 or 9 people there. And, you know, at that point, of course, you can't punish those who show up. You got to put on a good show. But it was tough in the early years because a lot of my relationships were based upon the status. I had a business card. I had a title. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to a dinner party, well, you know, what's the first thing people ask you?
What do you do?
What do you do? Mm-hmm. And I was going from saying I'm director of business development for Microsoft's Greater China region. People would nod. They would want to exchange cards. And then all of a sudden they'd say, what do you do? And I'd say, I deliver books in the back of yaks in rural Himalayan villages. And at that point, you're left standing alone at the chip dip. You've got it all to yourself.
My guest is John Wood. He is founder and board co-chair of Room to Read and author of the new book, Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. He's in town to speak tonight to the SMU Forum and also to the Communities Foundation of Texas. If you'd like to join in, you can call the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with John Wood, founder and board co-chair of Room to Read and author of the new book Creating Room to Read, A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we have Simreg on the line in Plano. Hi, Simreg.
Hello.
Hi, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. Thank you. I just had your speaker. I want to pick it off. I just wanted to actually make a great comment. I've been an admirer of you for a long time. And
are you with us? Oh, I'm afraid that we have lost that connection. Maybe she'll call
back. We didn't
back.
Hear whether she was an admirer of you or an admirer of me.
I'm quite sure she's an admirer of you.
Hopefully both of us.
Can you talk a little bit about how, besides, and not to take anything away from the number of books that you've given away, which is how many million at this point? Is it
12 million
12
books.
Million, okay. 12 million books, 15,000 libraries, 1,600 schools. What are the other ways that you measure your effectiveness as an organization?
That's a great question. We look at utilization rates. So when we open libraries, how many books are being checked out of the libraries? We look at measures of sustainability. So what percent of the schools had local community co-investment? What percent of the schools and libraries have government co-investment? We look at measures of sustainability. So after we've supported a library for 3 years and we kind of release it into the wild and say it's now going to be run by the community, we go back to measure whether or not those libraries are still up and running a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later. I'm proud to say that 98% of the libraries in our last survey that we had kind of let become independent were still up and running when we went back and surveyed. And we're very lucky that very famous former resident of Dallas, Melinda Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funds Room to Read's evaluations. And this is important to me. I was naive when I started Room to Read. I thought that it was enough to put some books in, and of course the local people will figure it out. But I learned early on you have to do, as Reagan said about Gorbachev, trust but verify.
Right.
And we're really lucky that the Gates Foundation funds these evaluations so we can hire outside evaluators who show up randomly, unannounced, do spot checks on the schools and the libraries and the literacy programs to find out, are these things working or not? Now, we know for a fact that not everything will be perfect. If this was easy, it would have been done by now. So when we get those reports back, those reports from the evaluators tell us, here's where we're strong, here's where we're weak. Now, what we've done from the very beginning is anybody can go to roomtoread.org and find our evaluations, and we post them up on the website, warts and all, because we want to run a transparent organization. And think about that for a minute. Imagine if a public company had, vision or guts or whatever it would be to say they're going to take and they're going to put everything on their website, warts and all, without blacklining the bad parts. Mm-hmm. We'd do that. When Charity Navigator ranks NGOs for transparency, they give them between 0 and 70 points for transparency. I'm very proud to say that we are given 70 out of 70. And that's part of the business ethic of Room to Read, is we don't think of ourselves as a charity. We think of ourselves as an organization that delivers services to the poorest parts of the world, but that's run in a very efficient, transparent, business-like manner.
What do you know about the multiplier effect of children who are taught to read and go home and share even basic skills with mom and dad who may not have had an education at all?
It's really big, because a lot of times also one of the reasons we want those checkout systems to be in place is so that the older sibling might read to or with the younger sibling. Mm-hmm. We had a little boy in Zambia, very poor country, Zambia, but very hopeful, wonderful people. It's been independent since 1964. But this little boy went home, and he'd lost his parents to AIDS. And so he went home, and he was reading with his grandmother. And his grandmother said, I'm ashamed that my little 7-year-old grandson's learning to read, and I've never learned to read. She went back to that school, and she said, may I sit in on this class? Mm-hmm. And so now she's sitting in the back of the classroom learning to read. Now, we thought that was an outlier. A month later, our Nepal team told us the exact same story about a 42-year-old mother in Nepal. Same thing happened. It wasn't a grandmother, it was a mother. She said, I want to learn to read. So she's come into the school now, is sitting in classes. Then she said to the school, well, let's do something at night where the other mothers can come in and also learn to read. So that was not an intended effect. We didn't design that, but it just happened naturally and magically, and that's part of the reason I feel like I have the best job in the world, because we work with so many communities who are so motivated. They realize that this is their chance. This could be the first generation to get educated after umpteen generations not getting educated.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Andy in Frisco. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I'm the president of the At-Risk Children's Foundation. And we've been taking care of 90 orphans in Haiti, providing schooling and education. And we've been donated land in rural Custine. And we built a water well there, and we have children from all over the community and the surrounding towns coming there and want to build a library and a school. We have a local inventor of Ubuntu Blocks, who we kind of got done some assessment trips on building with that there. My question is for John. Like, I have no idea how to start getting funding for this overall project. Where would be a good place to start?
Thanks for your call. Are you willing to share some secrets?
Yeah, definitely. I think, Andy, I like what you had to say, because I think that number one is don't talk about the problem. Talk about the solution. Too many charities, I think, get bogged down in talking about the problem. I think the sooner you can come up with kind of a plan and a budget is better, because then you can tell people exactly what you need. And if it ends up being that you need $20,000, you can figure out whether that's one person at 25 or whether it's 25 people at 1,000 each. But the more you can kind of, for lack of a better phrase, productize it, the better, so you can go out and sell it. And then I would say third, and Rumnari does this all the time, is tell people, sell people on the vision of the day they're going to go to that village and meet those kids they've helped, because people are looking for more meaning in their lives. And whenever I talk to people about funding Rumnari projects, I say, just imagine the day you're going to go to, you know, insert country X here, Laos, Cambodia, Nepal, South Africa, and be there the day the library opens, or meet those children that you're helping, meet the parents of the children you're helping, and have a little bit more hope in the world. And, you know, the subtitle of my book is A Story of Hope in the Battle for Global Literacy. The reason I put that in there is I just think the world needs more reasons to see solutions and to be optimistic. So good luck, Andy, and if I can help in any way, my email address is in the back of the book.
John, everybody's background is what it is, but I wonder if you have come to feel like your sort of extensive experience in corporate America, particularly in the tech sector at a time before the initial bubble burst, is helpful to you today in the way you approach business and the way you run this nonprofit company.
I think it is, and I should also point out that my co-founders, our CEO, for example, Aaron Ganju, is, you know, ex-Goldman Sachs, ex-Unilever. We have a lot of people on our staff who are ex-business people. It's not just that, because we also have people who are academic experts. You can't have only business people running a charity, because that would be a disaster. You have to have people understand literacy and gender equality. But we do have a lot of people who have worked in the business sector, and I think a lot of that for us is about taking those lessons that we learned. So at Microsoft, I learned that, you know, Steve Ballmer used to say, go big or go home. I've always believed that bold goals attract bold people. So when we started Room to Read, we said our goal is to reach 10 million children by the year 2020, right? We're not going to quit our jobs to do something small. Let's do it big. I was told that was a crazy hubristic goal. 10 million kids when you're a bootstrapped little charity just starting out. I'm proud to say that we're now going to on track to reach our 10 millionth child by the year 2015. We should be able to do that 5 years early. I think part of it for us with a business background is finding out ways to cut costs. If an for-profit business lets their costs get out of control, their competitors undercut them, and they're going to lose market share. Well, I believe that same thing should happen in a charity world, that those who are efficient should be rewarded. So I can give you a few examples of how Room to Read has found innovative ways to save money. This year, for example, we asked Lenovo to donate a laptop to every single one of Room to Read's 500-plus employees around the world, so we didn't have to buy it. We're, of course, asking Microsoft to donate the software for those laptops. Our fundraising offices in places like London, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Sydney, where real estate's very expensive, are housed by Credit Suisse. We had once upon a time a Goldman banker told me he had 3 million miles on American. He was flying so much on Goldman Sachs Business. And I rubbed my hands together greedily and said, what's your password? Well, he not only gave me access to his account, but then a bunch of bankers at Barclays heard about this, and they said, we're going to match Goldman mile for mile. So when I travel around the world now, it is for free because people have literally said, I don't need these miles. I'm going to give them to you. Hilton has given us 150 free room nights around the world. So as our staff travels, we can do it for free. Now, all of that in total aggregates up. Adding to that, then, we also have 10,000 volunteers who run fundraising chapters. They've kept their day jobs, but they're doing this as a volunteer project, including here in Dallas. Well, 10,000 people who are not on our payroll who work for us on fundraising, again, allow us to be very, very efficient. So the net result of that is that we deploy 83 cents in a dollar directly to programs. We are Charity Navigator 4-star rated for the last 7 years in a row. And only 2% of the NGOs in America have received 7 consecutive years of 4-star ratings. And a lot of it just comes down because we're not buying Land Rovers. We're getting cement donated by Lafarge. We're getting frequent flyer miles donated. All that stuff over time aggregates up and saves us literally millions of dollars.
I should say you're using local labor in the places where these schools are being and libraries are being constructed from the ground up.
Exactly. In many cases, it's unpaid labor. It's volunteer labor from the local communities. We try to use that wherever possible.
We have an email here that you actually anticipated before we started this show. Jai says, does your organization do any work in this country with the many thousands of people who are semi-literate or poor and live in rural areas?
Now, Room to Read's model, and I believe you can't try to solve every single problem in the world or else you become very, very unfocused. And so Room to Read's model is very much about the poorest parts of the world, where it's not that the school is underperforming, it's that there's not a school, or it's not that the library is closing early, it's there is no library. So Room to Read is working in places where a little bit of money goes a long way. Now, I do believe the question is valid, because if you believe in education, I think you should believe in it everywhere. But believing it everywhere means you can't draw these artificial lines of demarcation to say, well, we can only work in our own state or our own country. We live in such a globalized world. There's no longer moats and drawbridges like there were in the old days when the world was not interconnected. So I'm very proud to do the work we're doing in the poorest parts of the world because I believe all lives are equal. A child is a child is a child. Now, personally, I believe in the power of education enough that I teach at NYU in my spare time, which is not very much, but that's helping me to help a lot of graduate students to kind of think through how they're going to go change things, whether it be here in America, Haiti, Afghanistan, wherever it might be. And I also sit on the board of a wonderful group called the National College Advising Council, which is very much like Teach for America. They take really motivated recent college graduates, but instead of placing them in schools as teachers, they place them in schools as college counselors to help that next generation. I think about my own father and how much that university scholarship meant to him. Well, what if through groups like National College Advising Council, we can help thousands of more students today in poor rural or inner city schools to find their way to college? So for me, it's NCAC, it's NYU, it's Room to Read. If you believe in education, you got to believe in it and you got to do it. But I would challenge anybody with the simple question, what are you going to do today and what are you going to do this week? It's about the solution and how quickly we can get out there and implement it.
So what kind of plans in the not very distant future do you have for the day when hard copy books are really a minor player as opposed to a major player in the world of reading?
I don't think books are going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think the death of the traditional print book has been greatly over-exaggerated, and our teams see it every single day because our local language publishing program produces books. It literally costs us $1 to produce one book. We have a big thing we're doing now called the Checkout Challenge. It's a $1.5 million fundraising campaign. Guess what? It's going to allow us to produce 1.5 million additional books.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout the developing world, especially in a lot of places, you don't have electricity. They're off the data grid. So the idea that you can wave this magic tablet over a developing world village and the kids will magically get educated, I think is a total canard. And I think that, yes, I mean, I think once a child learns to read and is a reader, they become platform agnostic, right? I read on my iPad, but I also usually when I travel, but I also love to read books at home. I love the physicality of books, and kids love the physicality of books. The beautiful thing about a book is that, and I don't mean to turn this interview into a love letter to books, but the thing about a book is it's a single-purpose device. So when you're reading a book, that's all you can do. You can't tweet from your book. You can't check your Facebook. If you're reading a physical book, you're focused on that book. If I'm reading on my iPad, I quite often get distracted. There's stuff pinging.
Right.
You've got a new tweet. Somebody mentioned you on Twitter. I mean, I'm a big Twitter user. I'm John Wood RTR. But on the other hand, I think if you have a electronic device, you can get very, very distracted by news feeds, Facebook updates, et cetera. If you have a physical book, I focus on that book only for hours on end when I'm reading a book. So I don't think books are going away. I don't think libraries are going away. Sometimes people say to me, well, aren't books obsolete? Aren't libraries obsolete? And I always say, and I try not to be a smart aleck when I say it, but I say, you know what? I have never been asked that question by a poor person.
Hmm. What book did you read and reread the most as a kid?
Clifford the Big Red Dog was my absolute favorite book. I loved Go Dog Go by P.D. Eastman because anything for a little boy that captures dogs driving fast in cars.
I do not like that silly hat. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Big fan of Dr. Seuss. And then as I got older, I got addicted to Graham Greene and George Orwell and a number of other authors that I just could not stop reading them.
John Wood is founder and board co-chair of Room to Read and adjunct professor of social entrepreneurship at NYU's Wagner School of Public Policy. His new book is called Creating Room to Read, a story of hope in the battle for global literacy. He will speak today to the SMU Forum and the Communities Foundation of Texas. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.